The opt-out movement and the civil rights movement, they seem like a perfect match. Maybe not. We will ask Dr. Yahuru Williams why. Are people saying what they mean? The author of Cloaking Inequities doesn't think so. Plus, Matt Damon's mom checks in. We will have a moment of zen and take a look at the top trending stories in education. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker and Dr. Jed Hopkins. It's time to take a look at the top trending news stories in education. Number one.
Finally, we know how to fix schools. Take them over, remove school boards, and put managers in charge. Hence, the school takeovers. No, Jed, I'm obviously being sarcastic, facetious, you name it. According to the Center for Popular Democracy, we now have very conclusive findings that the school takeover model for, quote, failing schools has absolutely been a disaster. We see setbacks in the school in students' performance. There's fraud and mismanagement, high turnover, instability, disrupted learning environments, and, of course, students of color and special needs face harsh disciplinary measures and don't get what they deserve. If we're not going to take over a school that's failing, what do we do?
It's a trick question.
It's a trick question. Actually, what we do, Jed, curricula that's engaging, culturally relevant and challenging, high-quality teaching rather than high stakes, transformational parent and community engagement, inclusive school leadership.
Oh, that.
Yes, all of the things that we've been saying for the last
30. You mean the schools our children deserve?
Yes, we should do what the Yes. So the next time we take over a school, let's make sure we take over a school and make sure that it's a school our children deserve.
There you go.
Number two.
We thought we left no child behind. However, there is another child we forgot about. According to The Onion, we have let go a whole group of students. Students that don't give a shit. According to this study, 89% of students that don't give a shit don't do well on standardized tests.
I mean, that's like the elephant in the room, isn't it, really?
Yeah, I mean, think about, you know, we worry about students with special needs. We worry about students that come that haven't been fed. What about students who actually don't really care?
Right, right. I mean, God bless The Onion, really, for attending to this, you know.
Lazy students that don't care. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about this.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask her.
Actually, what I think is that standardized tests make kids feel lazy and not want to try and make them not give a shit. Because the standardized tests, except for a very small percentage, really, of kids who are comfortable with them, we know more and more that there's an enormous amount of anxiety kids have, stress they're experiencing, that the tests have felt so harmful to so many kids, and for a lot of kids who don't test easily, and that's an awful lot of them. They have to either grind it out like crazy. If they come from well-to-do families, they get tutors and they prepare for tests. But if they don't, then they're having an experience which is hours long and miserable for them and doesn't make any sense to them. That's making them feel bad about themselves and feel alienated and feel like, I hate school and this place isn't for me. I don't know if you ever read Todd Farley's book, Making the Grades, but that book is so funny.
Right.
My Misadventures in the Standardized Testing Industry, because it's full of answers created by these inventive students who have no idea how to actually answer the question, or maybe they do and they don't give a whatever, but they're just making up a funny answer. And it has you roaring with laughter at the creativity that kids are injecting into the standardized test. But, you know, on the sad side, the testing itself has had a devastating effect on curriculum and narrowing the curriculum and making school as a whole experience less interesting, less creative, and less appealing to most kids.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
He is a professor of history at Fairfield University. He's the author of several books, including Teaching U.S. History Beyond the Textbook. He's an editor of the Association of African American Life and History. His articles have appeared in the Black Scholar, the Journal of Black Studies, and the Magazine of History. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Dr. Yahuru Williams. The civil rights movement, the opt-out movement, they seem like a good fit. Why are they not getting along?
It's an interesting question, and I think there are a couple of reasons to them. I think the first one is that you have civil rights groups that really have been seduced into believing the rhetoric that's offered by the corporate reform industry, the charter industry, that somehow they are in the business of trying to rescue failed schools, that they can somehow improve graduation rates and deal with other issues that are plaguing schools by creating these charters, which they argue are superior to public schools, without really delving into the deeper issues of why the charters themselves are problematic, that they divert funding from public schools, that they rely on organizations like TFA, which are not highly qualified teachers, that they cherry-pick students, that they don't aggressively deal with not only issues of poverty, but English language learners, students with disabilities. In this way, you get this rhetoric and this narrative that, in some sense, this is the great civil rights issue of our time, and you hear people like Arnie Duncan articulating that, and yet the reality is they're not doing much to move the needle on any of the underlying socioeconomic problems that contribute to failing schools or so-called failing schools.
You're a leader in the African-American community. When you're sitting there, though, saying that this is a civil rights issue and opt-out is an acceptable response to the civil rights issue, but yet the civil rights community, and or I should say the leadership of the civil rights community, is saying opt-out is not the correct response. I'm trying to figure that out.
And you're not the only one. If you look at the civil rights movement, opting out, the idea that if you're dealing with an unjust system, the way that you respond, you put pressure on that system, is to highlight the lack of justice. You highlight the inequality in that system by acts of direct action protest. Opting out is an act of direct action protest. It's no different than sitting at a lunch counter or wading in at a segregated pool. It's a way that ordinary people can make their voices heard in a system where it is very difficult for poor people and people of color to be heard. Having said that, you have the civil rights leadership, which has received, in some instances, large donations from many of the supporters of high-stakes testing, many of the supporters of corporate education reform, who are being sold the idea and are buying into the idea that, you know, these charter schools, that corporate education reform is the best hope, and they simply apply the legacy of the civil rights movement to that movement without really connecting the dots or this being scholarly in any way. It's a fairy tale. And I hate to say it that way because in a lot of ways when people say that, they think that you're diminishing the argument. But I want to be very clear. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, the NAACP of the 1950s and 1960s, the whole push for the desegregation of schools, they never would have supported the way that the corporate education reform movement is attempting to deal with the issue of segregation. They would have fought for greater funding for public schools. They would have fought for more resources and support for teachers. And they certainly would not have done things to undermine unions, because unions were the backbone in many ways of the civil rights movement, were great contributors to the civil rights movement.
So in other words, they were more in tune with the structural nature of the problem, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They looked at this as a problem that the schools were simply one symptom of a much larger disease, poverty.
So let me ask you, are you hopeful that this will get through eventually?
I'm not, because there's so much money involved. Mm. I think at this point what we're seeing, and we saw this 2 years ago, when you had the Urban League coming out and supporting, you know, this rhetoric about corporate education reform and testing and charters, and this is being the great equalizer, that there's so much money involved that it's difficult for this leadership, this civil rights leadership, to really wade through this and to get authentic voices that are talking about the harm that's being done. This really has become a conversation of narrative. And to find people who are honest enough to really, you know, look at the issue objectively and to not deal with it in emotional terms and to really kind of stare squarely at the fact that high-stakes testing in and of itself, the adoption of Common Core, you know, all these other things where we have corporations making millions of dollars on these tests,
yeah,
no way dealing with the issues that are impacting communities of color in the country, unemployment, education, any of it.
Listen to you talk. Please explain to me why nobody hears you. Everything you've just said is so clear. I've heard you speak other places. I've seen your writings. It's not like this is hidden from the civil rights leaders. So when you say it's tough for some of them maybe to wade through and or hear the narratives, I find that that's almost itself a bit of an excuse for them not wanting to hear from what Yehuru Williams has to say.
Yeah, I agree. I think part of it is literally them having to confront the fact that this would be really dealing away their opportunity to have access to people with deep pockets. And when you're looking at established civil rights organizations like the National Urban League, like to a certain extent the NAACP, it's not in their interest to be on the wrong side of these organizations that can help to fund their initiatives, that can help to support, and that actively court and offer funding for other initiatives. The other side of it is the narrative itself, that it's very difficult for these organizations to disagree when you've got, for example, and no one will really wants to deal with this, an African-American president in Barack Obama who's pushing through this agenda through his Secretary of Education, and he himself is tying this to the legacy of the civil rights movement.
I was going to say, you know, an Arne Duncan is selling this narrative, as you put it, as a structural solution. It's sold as a systemic way of fixing the problem. And you were saying earlier that, you know, a Martin Luther King is someone who really gets the structural issues here, but the solution is being presented as also a structure, as a kind of a structural way. So it's a kind of a tricky thing here.
It's tricky, but it also, I think at its core, has to do with you know, the intellectual dishonesty in the conversation and the fact that you've got people like Duncan who, and it's not just Arne Duncan, it's this whole cadre of people like Paul Vallis, of Michelle Rhee, John King, who's recently confirmed as the new Secretary of Education, Cami Anderson, who built careers essentially destroying schools and undermining communities, but doing so in the name of raising standards and, you know, not dealing with the deeper structural issues at the same time that they're claiming by putting a Band-Aid on those structural issues that, in fact, they're advancing the cause of civil rights and social justice in the country.
How do we get that message back out to the people that the solution to the inequities in schools, in public schools, is not going to be through the deep pockets of a Bill Gates telling you which school to send your child to and which curriculum to have, but the inequities in the schools are going to be solved by, again, that grassroots civil disobedience. What we saw in the past, what worked. I mean, Martin Luther King and these guys didn't go to big dollars and ask for them to recreate the narrative. They sat down and said, enough's enough.
Well, I think part of the problem is that, you know, three quick things. Number one is the narrative itself. We have become so comfortable in talking about the civil rights movement as if it was embodied by one person, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. This was a grassroots movement. It was all about ground game in the civil rights movement, the ability of local organizations and local people to move agendas that impacted their communities that would link up to national issues like the push for a Voting Rights Act. So having said that, when we see students in Boston, for example, walking out of the public schools and protests, we see the situation in Detroit, Chicago, Philadelphia with students acting. We've got to get communities to respond to that and to appreciate that those students are really, in many ways, replicating what we saw during the civil rights movement by voting with their feet for what they see as the inadequacies and the failings of the reform agenda in their schools. I think the second piece is literally, beyond attacking the narrative itself, having a ground game. This is going to require us to go door to door in communities of color to correct the narrative. I think part of the problem is that what the corporate education reformers have been able to do through organizations like Khan Can and TFA is not only hijack the narrative, but actually hijack the structures of communication. So you've got organizations with deep pockets that are funding so-called community activists and communities of color to support the charter agenda. That's criminal. It happened in my home state of Connecticut, in the city of Bridgeport and other cities. We've got to stop that. And I think the third piece, literally, is finding a way to communicate this message in a way that's easily accessible and digestible to people that don't read blogs. You know, it's great that we have so many committed activists in the blogosphere who are raising these issues, so many committed activists in groups like United Opt Out and Badass Teachers Association. But, you know, this is a longstanding sociological phenomenon that poor people, that people that are suffering under the strain of poverty, don't join organizations. They've got more pressing concerns. Mm-hmm. So we've got to find a way to communicate our issues, these issues that impact them, in a way that they can digest and understand, hey, this is critical to my existence as well.
Busted Pencils, Fully Leaded Education Talk, and we have the honor of speaking with Yehuru Williams, and you were just finishing up your great third point. How about the students themselves? These are acts that truly do represent acts of civil disobedience, more in line with, quote, the historical civil rights movement. Is there a way to escalate or create an amplifier to show that these things are happening?
I think part of what we need to do is to create the mechanisms that they did during the civil rights movement, like a student nonviolent coordinating committee. The idea behind that being that if you've got students communicating, you know, these student unions in Baltimore and Chicago communicating, a victory in one school district, in one community, can have a ripple effect in other communities as well. So when we see these acts of civil disobedience in places like Newark and now in Boston, it's an opportunity for us to understand that these kids are capturing the airwaves. They're articulating in a way that people can't deny that there's real trauma that's taking place in those communities. And they're doing it in a way that I think is very important because it's authentic. And what you're getting, you know, you can't have the explanation that somehow these students have been riled up by adults. It's just happening in too many places and in too many communities across socioeconomic lines. We saw this in Denver in the fall of 2014. And those certainly weren't poor communities that we're talking about, the cutting back of music and the arts and social studies and the high-stakes testing and all these other things. So I think part of it is just empowering young people and finding a way to help young people in organizations like the Providence Student Union, the Newark Student Union, to communicate and to act in unison so that they can replicate some of the victories that they have. And maybe we're looking at something which sounds radical, but maybe we need in terms of a national strike, a national walkout of students and parents and teachers in unity to raise the issue to another level.
It sounds like there's a real possibility that we may be looking at a Chicago strike here coming up in April, but that's not the kind you're talking about there. We would be talking about bringing students, parents, teachers together in a strike for equity.
That's exactly what I'm talking about. When we look at the present election cycle and the lack of conversation on issues of education in the presidential debates, I think that's a reflection of a study was recently done by the Harvard Law Review that talked about the fact that, you know, a very small percentage of Americans consider education to be a top issue. They care more about economics and foreign policy. In order to get on the national agenda, in a way, in order to dramatize how important this is, we have to look at acts that really capture the headlines. And a massive walkout on the scale of not just one community, not just Chicago, because we've seen that happen with Diane, they didn't move the needle. They captured the national headlines, but not in a way that moved the needle. If we see this in multiple communities, it would be difficult for the media to ignore this. It'd be difficult for politicians to ignore it. And I think we'd get some substantive conversation about education in a way that we haven't had previously, because ultimately the corporate education reform narrative, the Arne Duncan narrative, wins out.
Well, there you go. You heard it from Yahuru Williams, and that's what we're looking for here to end this with. And let's put the call out now on Busted Pencils to all the listeners out there. We need a national equity strike, students, parents, teachers, all together until we get our schools back, bringing back civil disobedience in the form from the civil rights movement. And I just want to say thank you, Yahuru, for spending time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, guys.
This is Busted Pencils Radio. Fully leaded education talk.
He's a professor of educational leadership and policy studies at Cal State Sacramento and author of the blog Cloaking Inequities. Welcome to Busted Pencils, our activist blogger of the week, Dr. Julian Vasquez Heleg. Julian, why did you start the blog?
The reason why I started the blog was because academics, you know, the ivory tower, it's very rare for our work to be available to the general public, because when we publish peer-reviewed scholarship, it goes into journals, and those journals are behind subscription paywalls. So when I was originally thinking about, you know, doing this blog, I was doing it because as an academic, you know, a PhD from Stanford and, you know, having been at the University of Texas for 8 years and now at California State, I was really concerned that my research wasn't getting to parents and policymakers and community folks and other stakeholders. So I felt that we as academics, we haven't historically made our work readily available to the public. And there's that saying, there's that old saying, if it's not on the internet, it doesn't exist, right?
You're right. Whether it's behind a paywall or not, I'm also concerned about who's actually reading the stuff I put in those journals. And so the same reason I started taking the blogging too, and now this format here, the radio, is to say, you know, we have important things to say, and the academic journal has its place. However, if people really want to listen listen.
And I don't think it's an or proposition. Mm-hmm. It's actually an and proposition. I just received an email from a colleague saying just very simply, wow, you're getting a lot of stuff done. And the reason why he said that was because we also now have a podcast called Truth for America. It's now on iTunes. It's on SoundCloud. It's on YouTube. So not only are we bringing research, through the blogosphere, we also have our own podcast called Truth for America that focuses on conversations around Teach for America. And then just, talking about your point about who reads those articles, at ARA last year, and ARA is the big,
That's the American Educational Research Association for the listener out there.
Right. And so this is the big education conference that happens every year. 18,000, 19,000 people attend this conference. Well, last year at ARA, there was a session I attended, and they said the average peer-reviewed journal article is read by 10 people. Now, that doesn't mean that, some of the really famous ones on critical race theory or, Gloria Ladson-Billings or Pedro Nogueira or Linda Darling-Hammond or, these folks, their articles, of course, are read by many, many more people. But the average paper is read by 10 people. And so, really, if you look at my early, early blog posts back in 2012, the blog didn't look like it looks now with embedded YouTubes and embedded podcasts. In those days, I would have an abstract of a paper, and then I would talk a little bit about the paper, and then I'd have a picture of the journal cover, and that was about it, right? And so even my blogging has evolved past, to do lots of other things, but that was my original thinking behind the blog, was making this work more accessible, because a lot of the publishers, they'll restrict your peer-reviewed articles that if it's not on your own website, other people cannot host the PDF on their website. So if it's not an open access journal like EPAA or Critical Education or one of the others.
Every blog has to have a unique name, and so you've got yours, Cloaking Inequity, cloakinginequity.com. But where does the title come from?
It actually comes from the idea in critical race theory of camouflage, which is that in policy, the inequities are actually hidden in the policies. They're camouflaged, and then the equity concerns are sort of ameliorated. So that's why, I write about charter schools. I write about high-stakes testing. I write about Teach for America. I write about standards. I write about Common Core. I do some work on higher education access. And the main thrust is how these policies hide inequities while cloaking the conversations in wrapping them in civil rights discourse, and sort of revealing that many of these policies that we're talking about, whether it be, for example, school vouchers, and they're always talking about how school vouchers will help African-American kids, and they have in Milwaukee, et cetera. Well, one of the most recent articles out of Arizona shows that the vouchers are actually helping rich, wealthy folks send their kids to private schools. Or the latest study out of Louisiana that said that black kids that attend voucher schools are actually doing worse than those that attend the public schools, right? So, but there's this constant theme in the public discourse from neoliberal forces and the University of Arkansas and all the money that they have from the Walton Foundation and other places, driving this theme that these policies, these neoliberal policies, are about civil rights. And so what I try to do is uncloak those inequities that are hidden in those policies and not allow them to be swathed with themes of civil rights.
You are definitely doing that with that work. And Jed, you're sitting there thinking, man, he said it all.
He said it all. No, that's really beautiful.
For the listener, it's cloakinginequity.com. Dr. Julian Vasquez-Heleg, thank you so much for being on the show.
Julian, keep busting those pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk.
I do not think we have ever done a show more fitting to the teachings of Howard Zinn. Here is our weekly Moment of Zinn.
History is important. If you don't know history, it is as if you were born yesterday. And if you were born yesterday, anybody up there in a position of power can tell you anything, and you will have no way of checking up on it.
Want more Busted Pencils? Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Also, log on to BustedPencils.com to keep up with trending news, hear parts of the show, and nominate an activist of the week. For Jed Hopkins, I'm Tim Slecker, and thanks for Busting Pencils.